You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, why are American women having fewer babies? A historian looks at the long and complicated relationship between womanhood and motherhood. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, anger is all around us. It's part of who we are, how we interact, and it has its place and purpose. But we aren't always great at processing and communicating our anger. And we often really need help when we're on the receiving end of someone who's angry and treating us badly as a result. Those negative, potentially explosive interactions can be one-offs with someone you'll never see again, or they could be repeated with someone who's got a consistent presence in your professional, personal, or family life. Our next guest has advice for handling these situations, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. When and how do you interact with angry people? How do you handle it? If you work at a job where the customers or clients are sometimes mad at you, how do you react to that? Have you had a long-term family situation with anger that you found some way to resolve? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Martin is professor of psychology at UW Green Bay and author of the book Why We Get Mad. His new book is called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Now, we talked about your last book, Why We Get Mad, and that was meant as an aid for dealing with our own anger. This is for dealing with the anger of others. What led you to write this book?
Yeah, it actually started with a request from a friend who said she was dealing with other people's anger and was wondering if I could write. It started as a blog post a long time ago for Psychology Today. Said, would you take some time and give me some strategies? And then about 2 years ago, I turned that same blog post into a TikTok series, and it got a lot of interest, and a lot of people reached out and told me that they needed this kind of help. And so it felt like a good approach for my next book.
Before we get into strategies for dealing with angry people, you make an important distinction right up front between, you know, someone who's angry and something that might be a chronically abusive relationship where someone might use displays of anger as an instrument of control. This is a different situation than the anger we're mostly going to talk about here, right?
Yeah, I really want to make clear right out of the gate that this book is not for people who are in an abusive relationship. It's not for people who are being harmed by someone, either physically or emotionally. That's not what this book is for. It's for people who experience either through their job or because of someone they know, they live with or experience someone else who is angry. And it's important to note, too, that sometimes the angry people we deal with day in and day out aren't necessarily angry with us, right? They might be angry at the world. They might be angry often, and you're present for that anger, but it isn't necessarily directed at you in a way that is harmful or hostile.
Now, let's talk a little bit about anger as an emotional state. I'm angry in the moment. Compared with anger as a personality trait, that so-and-so is an angry person.
Yeah, like any emotion, anger is something that everybody feels. We feel it a couple of times a week to a couple of times a day. But at the same time, there are these individual differences with regard to how often or how intensely we experience anger. And some people are angrier than others. And for those people who are angrier than others, who tend to get angry more often, who get angrier than people typically do, or even who express that anger in really maladaptive ways, we tend to think of them as having being what we call high on trait anger, meaning that they have more of an angry personality trait. And so there are people out there who may know a person who's high in trait anger, and then this book is a good fit for them and offers some strategies there. There are also people, though, who, because of the type of job they have, usually service providers, who will tell you that they just work with, they encounter a lot of people who are high in state anger, because of the nature of the job.
Now, with different types of communication with angry people, you have a lot of suggestions that might work for any kinds of those interactions. The first one's really interesting. When we're dealing with someone who's angry, either in the moment or chronically, the notion that we want to work out what we really want out of this. How can we do that? How can we figure out, you know, what do I want to come from my interactions with this angry person? It sounds easier said than done in some ways.
Yeah, I think it often is. And that's why it's important to sort of step back and focus on that. When you're in an interaction with an angry person, you may find yourself wanting to do some things that aren't actually best for you or best for that interaction. And so what I encourage people to do is to think about their goals and think about their desired outcome. And what I mean is there are times where maybe you're confronted by someone, maybe someone is angry with you, and what you decide you want to do is get back at them in some way or lash out back at them. You know, when we're in this kind of emotional situation, we bring our own emotions to the table as well. And so when someone's angry at me, I might respond with my own anger. I might respond with some sadness. I might respond with some fear or guilt or something else. And so in that moment, sometimes we lose sight of what is best for us. And this first strategy is really about saying, okay, what is best for me? What is best to get out of this situation in a healthy, positive way? And it might be different than sort of what my instincts are telling me in the moment.
Talking to Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay, author of the new book, How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your advice, maybe your strategies for dealing with difficult people, say on the job, if you encounter a lot of anger in your line of work. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Pat is with us in Madison. Pat, hi.
Hi there. So I stayed angry for a long time in my life. I grew up with two alcoholic parents and, you know, very dysfunctional. And I learned that anger was a big cover-up for me for the sadness that I was dealing with. And I used to have these fits of rage. You know, they called me this angry person. And you know, I think the best strategy for me was to have friends and everybody just say, you know, what's really going on? You know, instead of saying, calm down, you know, if they just said, hey, you know, what's going on? And, you know, when I learned through going to Al-Anon to deal with the alcoholic parents, I found out that, you know, it was really just this big cover up. And I just needed people around me to just get me to calm down, you know.
Pat, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Ryan, that takes me right toward one of your steps that Pat's friends, it sounds like they understood this, understand anger from the other person's perspective. Could you talk about that, Ryan, and how it fits into Pat's story?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think one thing I'd note about that story is that there are a lot of people out there who point to anger as a quote unquote secondary emotion, meaning it stems from other feeling states like sadness or hurt or things like that. And that is absolutely true some of the time. And it certainly sounds like it was true this time. Sometimes anger can be a primary emotion, and sometimes it can really stem from other things. In fact, there was recent research that just came out that really found a link between those aversive childhood experiences, like he was describing, and adulthood anger, saying the more traumatic the childhood, essentially, the more likely you were to be experience anger in adulthood. Now, I think that one of the things that I think is really important is for people to be able to do what I call diagramming an angry incident from another person's perspective. And what I really mean there is think about what is causing that anger, but try to think about it in a really holistic way. So bring into it, you know, the ways in which they might be interpreting some of these, what's happening to them, some of when you know those childhood experiences, when you can think about how emotions were modeled for the person, which sometimes we can't do, but sometimes we can. Thinking about even the mood state they're in at the time of the provocation. Are they under a lot of stress? Are they exhausted? And so on. All of those, they do two things for us. One, it's about empathy. It's about learning to kind of see things from the other person's perspective, develop a little bit of understanding as to what they're dealing with and what they're going through. But it also might tell you where to intervene. And it might give you a sense for, okay, so now that I understand the cause fully and completely, instead of, as the caller mentioned, instead of just telling the person to relax, I can potentially, again, depending on my relationship with the person, dig into some of those causes. I can say, hey, what's really going on? And we can unpack some of that.
Pat, thanks a lot for that call. We are talking to UW-Green Bay professor of psychology, Ryan Martin, about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how to deal with angry people? Do you have an anecdote, a story to share about a time when you or someone you interacted with was the angry party, how the situation played out, escalated, or was resolved in a better way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW-Green Bay, and we're talking about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. You can join in with your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Heartland. Beth, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Beth?
So one thing that I'm noticing, I am in a public education, and the thing that I see is that when I'm angry with somebody for, like, the experience today was somebody not holding up the end of their job, not doing their job, actually. And what I found was that I could be angry at the person who didn't follow through, and yet I needed to separate my feelings toward the person who didn't do their job and yet be really action-oriented toward putting the student first. And, like, making sure that the student is focused on first and taking an action step to make sure the student's needs are met versus being angry at the person for not doing their job.
Okay, Beth, I got to ask, this sounds great. Is that easy for you to do? Because I think I would have a hard time, you know, staying that calm and taking my feelings out of it.
Well, and I think that it's important for us to take a little space and mentally say, okay, first we're going to deal with, like, for our situation today, that there wasn't a process in place for this to happen. And so I can say, like, let's think about a process first so that it doesn't happen again. Because I have to take my feelings out of it. But there's a little voice inside my head that says, this is not about you, Beth. This is about making sure that we have a process so this doesn't happen again.
Fantastic.
And I feel like people are able to take that because then they don't get attacked, right? And we put the kids first.
Beth, thanks so much for sharing that. Ryan, sounds like Beth is a pro. And again, she's talking, I think, right out of your book here.
Yeah, I mean, there is an art and a skill to being able to stay calm in those situations and ultimately redirect that and channel that for anger or whatever emotion you're feeling into something sort of positive and pro-social. I'm a big advocate for trying to solve problems when you are feeling anything. I mean, I think at a very, very basic level, one of the things our emotions are telling us is that we've got some sort of problem. And so a way of dealing with that is to try and solve whatever that problem is. Of course, finding ways to stay calm and keep your cool is it's one of the things I talk about in the book, and it is a real, it's a real art that takes a lot of practice and time.
Beth, thanks a lot for that call. Let's dig into that, Ryan. Somebody's mad at us. They're yelling at us. The last thing I probably feel then is calm and collected. How do I get there?
Yeah, so this is such a challenge, and I can't say that there's a simple way to do it. A couple things I advocate. One is to actually take some time to reflect back on experiences after the fact, to do a little bit of practicing in your head. I liken it to how athletes oftentimes watch game tape. You know, if you think through this interaction and maybe ask yourself, where could I have done things differently? Or where could I have handled this situation a little differently? Not in a way that is self-critical, which I think people often do, but in a way that is really reflective and preparing for future experiences. One of our goals has to be to find that moment to pause and to kind of hit that pause button and learn to relax in the moment. That comes through practice. That comes through sort of intentional activity and reflection.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I guess I got two parts to it. One is my experience in my adult life is with men, anger very often manifests with aggression and threats, physical threats. And the other part that I've heard about is that, at least for older men, I guess senior, older than 60, men that can suffer from depression, that the depression can manifest as anger.
Interesting, Tom. Thanks for those questions. Let's start with the first one. When anger ends up intentionally or unintentionally being a threatening, aggressive display, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's it is undeniable that men are more likely to express their anger outwardly than women are. Not necessarily through aggression, but sometimes through aggression. So outward expressions of anger can include also just yelling and swearing and screaming and things like that, but not necessarily with the intent to harm. When there is that intent to harm, one of the things I talk about is you really need to disengage in those moments and prioritize safety above and beyond all else. As for the piece about depression, I think that's one of the things that's really interesting. And I suspect in many ways the caller is right. And I also think that there's probably some generational differences that might be present there, in the sense that, you know, oftentimes men have been taught historically not to express particular feelings like sadness or fear. And so I do think there is a tendency for some of those feelings to come out in other ways. And I think that's particularly true of older generations that have, where that there wasn't really as much modeling of some of those other emotional expressions.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Ryan Martin about his book, How to Deal with Angry People. Ryan, I want to conjure up a scenario here. We had an airline fiasco not that long ago where gate attendants were dealing with lots and lots of angry people who couldn't get where they were going. The gate attendants had really nothing to offer them, thanks to their company, to help them out with it. In that situation, somebody's angry at you because of something that's not your fault and you really have nothing to solve their problem with. How could you deal with that kind of anger with your customers?
Yeah, I think a lot of times dealing with that sort of frustration is, obviously when we can solve their problem, we should, especially if we're the ones who are in part responsible for it. But I think that sometimes what people actually really want is to feel heard. And so taking moments to listen, feel that sort of, to sort of empathize with them, and to do what we can is really, really important. Again, it doesn't mean tolerating abuse. It doesn't mean tolerating a real intense hostility, but it means sort of hearing and giving them that space to share that frustration.
And then a much more personal setting, and you write a lot about this in the book, where someone might have a family member and they feel that family member, they like them for the most part, love them probably, but anger, at least periodically, chronically, gets in the way. What are some strategies for dealing with that kind of long-term anger within your own family?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's really tough, you hear a lot from people that online that I've talked to say, you know what, if I'm surrounded by someone who's angry, I just want to disengage and cut them loose and they're toxic and do away with them. And one of the things I found in talking to people is that isn't really for many people, realistic, and it isn't necessarily what they want to do. They want to have a relationship with that person, and they feel compelled because that person is sort of entangled in their life in all sorts of ways through their siblings or through their kids or their other parents or whatever. And so they really want to have some sort of relationship with them or feel like they need to have that relationship with them. I think there is the possibility of sort of disengaging in some ways, meaning maybe you minimize contact or you keep contact in only in certain ways. You find ways to effectively communicate with them that might be different than some traditional ways. So maybe you text them more frequently instead of actually having a face-to-face conversation, things like that to try and engage. I also think there are times where, and plenty of people that I talked to advocated the just direct conversation, saying, you know, this is what I'm seeing, this is what I'm concerned about, and I think we need to sort of reframe how we interact moving forward.
And briefly, Ryan, I want to take this back to your first book now. How can we diagnose if we are the person who's putting other people in this situation in the first place? How do we diagnose our own problem anger, just briefly?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One is doing your part to listen to what people are telling you. And so if people are giving you that information that your anger is distressing to them, I think you got to hear that and take it to heart, especially if they're people you're close to. I tend to focus on the consequences, though. Think about the way there's nothing unhealthy about anger on its own, but think about the ways that your anger might be causing relationship distress, might be causing you some emotional distress, might be leading to other sorts of problems. Pay attention to that sort of thing, and I'll give you a pretty good clue.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. We talked to him about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, gun violence numbers are very different from one region of the United States to another. And a guest tells us it may have a lot to do with the culture and history unique to those regions. And a copyright lawsuit targeting songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran was rejected. A lot was riding on that case for the music of the future. Find out what's at stake and what it means to make original music. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, online paywalls for news sites can create an information gap between those who can afford to pay for news and those who can't. A Wisconsin journalism expert joins the show to look at possible solutions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, former Wisconsin Badgers linebacker Chris Borland joins the show to share the new athlete storytelling platform he co-founded. First, the comedian Roy Wood Jr. hosted this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner. He delivered a speech that was half comedy roast and half social commentary. Speaking to a room full of reporters and editors from some of the biggest publications across the country, he pointed out one of the biggest problems he sees in the media industry today.
All the essential fair and nuanced reporting, it's all stuck behind a paywall. People can't afford rent, people can't afford food, not healthy food, they can't afford an education, they damn sure can't afford to pay for the truth. Say what you want about a conspiracy theory, but at least it's affordable. I mean, well, unless you Alex Jones, it costs you about $900 million. And I understand that we have to put the stuff behind the paywall because creating the truth is important. People can't afford the truth, but you all can't afford to go find the truth for free.
Wood's speech highlighted a challenge journalists face when it comes to funding their work. Quality reporting can be expensive, it takes a lot of time, and online ad revenue alone generally isn't enough to pay for it. Paywall subscriptions can generate the kind of revenue needed to pay for in-depth journalism. That can create, though, an information gap between those who can afford to pay for quality reporting and those who can't. It's a problem that outlets around the country are struggling to work through. Some are experimenting with new and creative ways to fund their work while keeping their reporting as accessible as possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get frustrated when you run into online paywalls for that article, that one article that you want to read? Do you subscribe to some publications, local, regional, national, that have these kind of paywalls? Do You feel like you miss out on quality journalism because you can't afford to subscribe to these services. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. This summer, she'll take over as the new director of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm so happy to be here.
How big a problem do you see this being, that there may be an information gap between people who can afford to subscribe to news services and those who can't?
I think that there's always been a problem with that, with having balanced and reliable information. You know, people subscribed to the newspaper in the 1950s and 60s, and people who could afford it did, and people who couldn't afford it didn't. So the gap isn't necessarily something that's new. What's new is the malignancy of conspiracy theories, misinformation, disinformation that is free. So this is now available to us online when it wasn't in the 1950s or 60s when my parents were subscribing to the Milwaukee Journal.
Are there things about the economics of the news media now that makes it more of a reach for people, especially to get local reporting that's valuable to them, given the economics of the situation?
Yeah, the economics for local news are not pretty. And it relates in part to a loss of subscribers, but also, importantly, a loss of advertisers. So if you look about 10 to 12 years ago, we are now, we were at about 12% of the national ad spend. So everyone from your local car dealer to Dove Soap was going toward local news. Now that number is about 2%. So you see advertising going to other places, including targeted social media advertising.
Now, the information gap we started with was between those who could afford a subscription and those who couldn't. How about between places that are maybe bigger cities that are packed with media outlets and smaller towns, rural communities? Is that so-called news deserts? Is that an information gap you worry about?
It's absolutely an information gap that I worry about. News deserts are very, very serious in places like Wisconsin and, in fact, all over the country. But one of the things that some research is showing is that those news deserts have increasing polarization, because they don't have the local news outlet. They're sort of nationalized in their politics. So rather than thinking about who's the neighbor I want to run for the local school board, they're more heavily fixated on, say, a Senate race in Georgia, because their news sources are more nationalized.
Let's look at different possible funding models for, you know, the online age of news. Now, for a while, there was the idea that we're going to do it all with web advertising, online advertising, which means we're going to have so many stories that go so viral and we'll get so many clicks. And how's that worked out?
It hasn't worked out. We have not solved the advertising conundrum for news in any way. And so we do have to look at other funding models. Part of that's going to be philanthropy. Part of it is going to be looking at things like nonprofit approaches, and then also public media, like we're on right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about paywalls? It seems like some news outlets, some of the big national newspapers, have enough of a subscriber base, enough of a reach that is a viable model.
It is, especially depending on your audience. The Wall Street Journal probably has the most viable paywall, given that a lot of businesses pay for its subscriptions for their employees. I think you are seeing some real thoughtfulness and some ethics and integrity coming into paywall discussions now, particularly when we went through COVID and people needing all of that information. Most outlets put that information outside of in front of their paywall so that you didn't have to pay to get it. And so now I hear from some editors and publishers who are saying, you know, hey, maybe it makes sense to have the latest Green Bay Packers Aaron Rodgers trade behind the paywall, but I'm going to put this election information out in front of it because, sadly, some people are more likely to pay for Packer info than they are to figure out who to vote for.
I know this isn't a brand new concern with the internet, but is there a worry that, okay, if I know a certain group of people can afford to pay for my web service, for my newspaper, I'm going to craft my news to appeal to that kind of customer?
Sure, to appeal to that kind of customer, and then also to appeal to what's the most clickable. Are we getting more sensationalism? Are we getting less substantive coverage? Those are all really important worries.
Do you think we are getting more of that? Because I know I've talked on the show about, you know, the 1800s, a newspaper publisher who had a great series on the discoveries of life on Mars with surprising detail. Like, sensationalism isn't new. Do you think it is in some ways worse now?
Sensationalism is not new, but it has more reach than it used to have. In some ways, in some ways less reach because we do have fewer super powerhouse, everybody, you know, watches Walter Cronkite kind of figures. We are, there's more atomization, so there's more choice. But those things that are bogus are getting better reach now.
Talking to Kathleen Culver from the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison, looking at access to news, affordability of news services in the modern media age. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you subscribe to a physical newspaper? Do you pay to see the stories behind paywalls on your local newspaper, a big city newspaper, one of the national outlets? Does it keep you away, a paywall, from seeing stories you want to see? Call in and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Allison in Madison couldn't stay on the line, but wants to know about the importance of libraries in accessing news and whether that's changed with online paywalls. Now, a lot of libraries do have subscriptions to periodicals and daily papers.
I love Allison's question because I could not possibly be a bigger fan of the public library. You know, when we talk about news deserts, one of the things that we think about is what other civic institutions are important in bringing us together, in getting us to talk about the local soccer team, to pay attention to the new business opening. And I think that libraries are one of those critical civic institutions. And they are places that we can access information, reliable information, for free.
Thanks a lot for that question, Allison. You also mentioned, Katie, outlets saying, okay, maybe that Packers news, you got to pay for that, but the election news, we'll let you have at least some of that for free. I know during COVID, some paywall outlets put the daily COVID tracker information in front of the paywall, not behind it, so people get it. What other kind of distinctions could we make between, okay, this is our public service and you can have it for free versus this is stuff you got to pay for?
You know, it's such an important and vital question. And I bump into it sometimes with people who contact me because someone has tried to share something with them and they used to be able to access it if it was shared via social media. But a lot of outlets have now changed that practice as well. So I think vital civic information, there's an argument for that to be in front of the paywall. But then also each of us as citizens asking, what investment are we making in news? And that you may not enjoy your local news outlet and it may be too expensive and you don't want to place your investment there. Are you maybe making a donation to public media? Are you looking at other ways to support news? Because it's not just on the news media to fix this problem. All of us who need that information have to be invested too.
We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professor Katie Culver about online paywalls and the costs of quality journalism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you're in a news desert in some ways where, especially maybe for local news, local government news, you don't get a lot of reporting on it, maybe not as much as you used to? And at whatever level, do you subscribe to a newspaper, whether in print or online? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Katie Culver, professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. We're talking about journalism behind paywalls and the conflict between access to quality reporting and how to pay for it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What kind of reporting are you willing to pay for? Is there something that you subscribe to? Love to hear what it is. Would you be willing to pay more for a particular kind of journalism, a particular coverage maybe in your local area? What questions do you have about how journalism is funded or not funded in some cases? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Katie, you mentioned briefly earlier there are nonprofit models, not just public media, public radio, and public TV. What kind of things do you see out there that look promising?
I think the Salt Lake Tribune is one of the more promising nonprofits. Startups, it's a long-standing legacy paper, but they went to that model a few years ago, and they are making it work. Right here in Wisconsin, there's the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism that does, it's on, at wisconsinwatch.org. They do phenomenal work. There are a number of those peppered across the country. They're not easy. This is not easy to make these go.
Yeah, have we seen some come and go? Are there failed models of nonprofit attempts at journalism?
Sure, plenty of them, And I think we have the opportunity to learn from those, but we also need to be sure that there's an audience to support that nonprofit approach. There are some that are tremendously successful, in fact, winning Pulitzer Prizes and the like. I'm hopeful in part, but we need to invest in it.
Something I wonder about, something I worry about is, you know, every community has county board meetings and city council meetings and school board meetings. And they can be a little dry to sit through in person. I've been there. But that kind of coverage can be really important. And it might be the most important for some people. It's what's happening in their backyard. Do you see models that work in communities that may not have a huge, you know, population to begin with?
I do think there's the possibility for citizens to get involved. We're seeing more of that activity going and looking at school boards, for instance. But you're right. When there is not systematic local coverage, there are all sorts of shenanigans and malfeasance that could go on. There's the tiny community of Bell, California, lost its regional newspaper reporter, and within a short span of time, some very powerful people there had bilked their citizens out of millions of dollars because there was no journalist watching.
Let's go back to our callers now. Barry is with us in Green Bay. Barry, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Barry?
Yes, I'm interested in your conversation. I equate having a subscription to your local newspaper with patriotism. I mean, I know that the media has been called the fourth estate. I can't imagine that any of the other three, portions of the government would in any way be functional without having a critical media. We've seen evidence of the fact that now the judiciary has rejected the scrutiny of the other two branches of the government. And what other alternative is there but to have the media shaming them continuously? And it's going to take years probably to get that judicial institution to begin to actually shine the light on its own.
Gotcha, Barry. Thanks a lot for the call. There's a Thomas Jefferson quote, I think, that I'm
going to
butcher here, but I'd rather have a press without a government than government without a press, something like that.
Yes.
That reminds Barry's thoughts. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Barry is spot on, and thank you for recognizing the role of journalism. Now, that's not to say that journalists always get it right, mm-hmm. that they always serve as the best check on other powerful institutions. Sometimes they're very much in line with other powerful institutions. Mm-hmm. But I think we have example upon example of example here in Wisconsin and across the country where we are served as citizens by the work of journalists who do their job with integrity.
Thanks a lot for that call. Chris joins us now in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Yes. So first off, I just wanted to say thank you to NPR for putting a spot on this, as always. Terrific. And second of all, I don't know if my wife and I are kind of the exception to the rule, but we are constantly, regardless of paywall, trying to seek out the most fair and honest reporting to make the best judgment of government or what's going on locally. So unfortunate as it is, in as much as I disagree that it shouldn't be, journalism has to be funded in some form. So if we have to, we're happy to pay for it if need be.
And Chris, may I ask, do you and your wife subscribe to any particular outlets?
We run the gamut. We go around the country. We look for, I'd like to go to look at what's going on in L.A., San Diego, New York, Chicago, to try and get a feel of what's going on around the country. And it helps give a balance to what a reporter might be bringing forward.
Chris, thanks for the call. Katie.
You know, I think Chris, thanks again, Chris, for being a great news consumer. I think you raised an interesting point that makes me remember I should have pointed to two other things. So really in the area of antitrust, that's something where news organizations are held up by law from cooperating and setting subscription prices and that sort of thing and subscription agreements. So, you know, as Chris tries to look at Arizona, L.A., wouldn't it be great if he had one central, you know, news subscriber account where he could go to all of these other outlets. You know, everybody is like, oh, I pay for this Gannett paper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but I go to the Gannett paper in Tennessee to try to find out what's going on there, and I can't log in. So I think that's an important element. And then also related to antitrust, news outlets have not been able to band together to deal with big tech when it comes to setting ad rates. And that's a real problem. There was an effort to push that forward, a bipartisan effort in Congress last year. It went down in flames, unfortunately. But that's something that we're going to need to look at, too.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Katie, for years I was hearing like, okay, we're right on the verge of microtransactions for media. So you know, I'm online a lot for my job. And hey, there's this cool article in the Miami Herald or Philadelphia Inquirer. The model was supposed to be I could put $50 into an account and I'd open this article for $1. That seems to have disappeared. I haven't heard anything about that lately.
Well, a lot of us were hopeful that if Elon Musk were living on planet Earth instead of on Mars, that's what he would have done with Twitter. He would have turned it into a micropayments platform that actually could have helped support publishers for the work that they do put out. I haven't lost all hope, but again, we're not going to see any forward motion on that when we have antitrust restrictions on publishers.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Katie Culver from the UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics, looking at how we pay for our news, whether we pay for our news. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Dan joins us now in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Hi. Say, there's a site on the internet called archive.is. It's pretty easy to get to. It's about a week behind, but almost every article printed in this country and around the world is posted on that. It's a free service, and like I said, it's about a week behind, but it's, you know, if you can't afford it, you can afford this.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I've seen links to this. I'm not sure how it works legally and or ethically, Katie.
Yeah, there's some real intellectual property questions around this. But some news outlets are trying, testing being part of free services to bring people in and then drive them to other content and bring in more eyes on their ads. So just be careful. Anything that's offered for free, always ask what's the quality of that and do they really own it?
Speaking of, thanks again for that call. Speaking of, you mentioned the links between social media and journalism. Obviously, a lot of people on social media share links to journalism. A lot of questions about how the money flows, who ends up profiting from this. The infamous pivot to video from a few years back where Facebook basically single-handedly persuaded newspapers to start doing more videos that I think hardly anybody watched. Your thoughts on social media and how it's affected journalism?
Well, it's affected journalism in a lot of ways, but one of the ways that I like to point to the most is that it's important to think about ethics right now, not just in terms of journalism, but in terms of all public communication. So, you know, journalism is my life, and I will love it forever. But it's one piece of our information ecology. And if the other pieces of that ecology are toxic, then we have problems. You know, I noticed in the news break leading in that we saw that we were hearing a news story about an amazing rise in youth voters. That is not driven by local newspapers. Mm-hmm. That is driven by TikTok. And so if we have a prayer for the future, it's got to be that all public communicators feel a sense of responsibility to truth and to minimizing harm and the like.
Yeah, that's it. It's a constant dilemma, even for us at public radio. How much do we do on a social media platform? How reliable is that platform as ownership changes, whether that's Elon Musk or a Chinese company owning TikTok? How are you seeing journalism outlets try to navigate that?
I think a lot of journalism outlets recall very well the hard lesson they learned with the, quote, pivot to video and almost universally lost money on that experiment. So I think there's a little bit more of a conservative approach now, but definitely an emphasis on younger users, readers, viewers, and bringing in that audience. And given that they're more politically engaged than their predecessor generations, maybe they will turn more to news. I can only hope.
In just our last minute, what do you have your eye on now? What is on the horizon that has you excited and or worried or both?
Actually, that youth engagement does have me very optimistic. My glass is very half full with the generation that's coming through my classrooms right now. They're smart. They want to be informed. They want neutral information, and they really care. They want a world that aligns with their values, and that makes me very optimistic. Now, if I can just convince them to read up for something other than answering my news quizzes, that'd be great.
Katie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to be here.
Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about the role of online paywalls in news coverage and how we can make high-quality reporting financially viable for news outlets and their audiences. Coming up after the news, a new project aims to share the stories of college athletes in their own words. Star UW-Madison football player Chris Borland is a co-creator. He and his partner joined the show to tell us about it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.